Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to The List, your guided tour through the living museum of popular culture. Today, why is it that we endlessly quote from our favourite films and TV shows? In a special edition of The List, we're looking at one of the most profound yet least scrutinised ways our culture influences us, the very language we use. That's coming up on The List.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I am the one who knocks.
Fall for you, Glen Coco. You go, Glen Coco.
My mom always said, life was like a box of chocolates.
My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Mandy Patinkin there in The Princess Bride, the 1987 film which added a whole bag of words and pithy quotes to the cultural lexicon. But what is it that makes any particular film quotable? This week, in a special edition of The List, we explore the relationship between the culture we consume and the language we use. It's not all movie quotes and comedy, though. There are deeper questions afoot. How has the digital age shaped the words we use to relate to ourselves and to others? How do dictionaries, long the defining record of language, keep up with the sheer amount of new words and the rejigging of existing ones? What, for instance, would a lexicographer think about bubbling, a word that captured media attention following the controversy surrounding footballer Todd Carney? For this special edition, we're going to be taken by the hand by guest host and linguistics tragic Tiger Webb.
It's funny. Everyone has a favourite film or TV show they love to quote from. Some people, and I'm sure you know a few, will memorise entire scenes or even whole films. But why do we do this? Where does this urge to regurgitate the language of our favourite bits of pop culture come from? Lauren Gawne is a linguist from the University of Melbourne. When not documenting endangered Tibeto-Burman languages in Nepal, Lauren helps run the fantastic Australian language blog Superlinguo, and she's looked a lot at what happens when language meets popular culture. Lauren's mother used to quote from TV shows Lauren had never seen all the time.
I know nothing, which is Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes, is kind of from the late 60s, early 70s. I just thought that when my mum denied something, she just kind of went a bit crazy because I didn't have the same reference for that TV show that she did. Another example, I just thought that Barcelona was a place where incredibly stupid people came from. But in fact, she was making extended and very subtle references to Basil Fawlty and Fawlty Towers. I'd never understood. A lot of TV shows get quoted in my household. We can never have a conversation about, for example, monorails without the Simpsons monorail coming into play somewhere there.
Well, sir, there's nothing on earth like a genuine, bona fide, electrified six-car monorail. What I say?
Monorail.
What's it called?
Monorail.
That's right, monorail.
Monorail. Monorail. Monorail.
I hear those things are awfully loud.
It glides as softly as a cloud.
Is there a chance the track could bend?
Not on your life, my Hindu friend.
What about us Brendan slobs?
You'll be given cushy jobs.
Were you sent here by the devil?
No good, sir, I'm on the level.
So what is it about The Simpsons in particular? What are we saying about ourselves if we communicate entirely in words from the town of Springfield?
The Simpsons is an incredibly massive cultural touchstone for the later half of Generation X. It was an absolutely massive phenomenon in the early 1990s. For so many people of that era, there are so many salient quotes. And I think a lot of this became a way to indicate your status as a watcher of The Simpsons and therefore someone who was in touch with popular culture. But the problem is now that my husband likes to use these quotes and family members who are in their early 20s or younger friends of ours just don't get what he's talking about. This has really put him in a place of angst. Humans are very social creatures and we like to share with people what we like as a way of identifying whether they're people that like the same things as us, whether they're part of our group, and that we're kind of savvy to things that are cool within our social circle.
Like, what's some of the forms that this can take? Is this new words? Is this sort of existing words being recast? What's happening here?
There's really, language is a very useful thing when it comes to being playful. We can be very, very playful with language, and this can take many, many forms. So there are those amazing people, and I'm definitely not one of them, who can quote verbatim incredibly long tracts of dialogue from their favourite film, or would know extended passages from their favourite book, or people who can recite poetry. These people have always amazed me. And then there are people who might sneak a more subtle reference to something they like into another conversation, or people kind of using visual imagery from films or TV shows they like. It's not always language, but I think language is a very easy way to share your interests and share your knowledge of these, of quotable things.
While it might seem as though this tendency to quote from film and TV shows is a new thing and evidence of us further tumbling down some sort of cultural precipice, Lauren reckons this phenomena might not be so new.
You know, it was part of your classical education was to learn poetry and create allusions to earlier works and riffing on existing ideas. And I think since postmodernism came about, people have a lot of angst about borrowing and re-quoting and reusing. But it's something that humans have always done to show their knowledge of what has come before them and where they fit within that. So I think the problem is that people are angsting over quoting of popular culture instead of quoting high culture. Quoting high culture still has enough cred that it's, you know, acceptable, whereas quoting from television has been seen as being less classy, so to speak. Mm. But it's still using the same skills and the same play with language. It's just that we now have a massively literate population in the way that we didn't even a couple of generations ago, and that's really changed how people interact with the media that they consume.
Okay, and I wonder, how does something like the internet change the way we reference pop culture?
For television shows, you tend to find that people will congregate in these little web communities and making references to the TV show and the characters and common phrases within them is a way of identifying yourself as an in-member of that community. And so Whovians, as Doctor Who fans are often known, kind of create versions of the language written in Doctor Who.
But it's not just Doctor Who and science fiction, which is a community that's always been prone to active fandom. Now, even fans of more high-prestige cultural auteurs are getting in on the act.
Aaron Sorkin is another great example of someone who has a style and his fans really identify with that style. And there are great supercuts of Aaron Sorkin shows that just string together all of his favourite language tropes and these phrases and buzzwords that his characters will use across multiple TV shows often.
You are a good man, Josh.
Yes, I really am quite something.
I'm really quite something.
I'm really something.
I'm quite something.
He's really quite something.
It was really quite something.
Yeah, and I think this is something that is a hallmark of our kind of current era of quotability, is that there's not just a currency in quoting or making allusions to a text, but there's incredibly important cachet in being someone who identifies this trend and identifies it as it's exploding into prominence. And so selfie is a really great example from last year. So selfie was chosen as word of the year by a number of different dialect societies and language societies. And it's one of the few that kind of hasn't died immediately on being observed. And we get this a lot of words, you know, no one says cowabunga anymore. No one says radical anymore.
But that's
no one will demand to occupy something anymore.
That's interesting though, isn't it? But you know, some people do kind of self-referentially say, "Oh yeah, man, like that's they will bring back these daggy words."
But there's a bringing backness, and there's a, oh, you use cowabunga because you're being slightly ironic and the early 90s are cool again, but he used cowabunga with a straight face, so he's not cool, he's not in. And I think the, you know, this kind of self-awareness of the quoting that we're doing is a real hallmark of how people are using language today, and it's part of a very high turnover popular culture that we see on the internet and across social media, where a meme kind of now has a half-life of about 72 hours. We're talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger saying, "I'll be back," in Terminator, and then saying it again in Terminator 2. And then by Terminator 3, it's become a joke, and so it has to be in there. And then it turns up in another Schwarzenegger film that's not even part of the Terminator universe. And it's now kind of bigger than the film and lives as its own cultural moment, kind of regardless of the film. Arnold Schwarzenegger, I think because of his kind of accented English, has quite a few of these. And quite often, for example, I've never seen Kindergarten Cop, but when he says he has a tumor, you know, the fact that you can quote things from films that you've never seen is often a good indicator of their translatability and quotability.
I'll be back. Ha! You did not going to say that, did you?
That's what you always say.
I do.
We opened the show with a grab from The Princess Bride, a film that almost every Gen Xer knows back to front. For people of my particular vintage, especially girls, the equivalent film that everyone can quote at will would be something like Mean Girls, the Lindsay Lohan vehicle written by Tina Fey. But what is it that gives films like these their high quotability?
You've got catchiness, you've got a quirky story that was doing something different to what other films were doing at the time. You had a great cast of comic actors. And I think Mean Girls is the same, you know. In many ways, it's a trashy school comedy, but it's written by Tina Fey. And Tina Fey says, you know, people who see this as teenagers really see it almost as much as a documentary as they do a comedy. They don't. It's kind of older people who see the real humour in it. And so there's lots that's quotable about that film too for different people.
So should we be worried about this relentless recycling of quotes from pop culture?
This is something that people have been doing for a very, very long time, whether it's people on the internet today putting captions on cats or monks quoting from earlier versions of biblical texts in creating their own kind of exegesis of it. So it's fascinating, and it shows a lot about how people love language and love using language to create groups and to create who's in these groups and the identity of these groups. And that's why I think it's really exciting, and it's not necessarily an indication of reaching the end of any meaningful culture because we're regurgitating stuff. I think it's a different phenomenon in itself.
Lauren Gawne is a linguist, columnist and blogger on language from the University of Melbourne. You can find details about her blog Superlinguo on our website. And you're listening to The List, your weekly dive into the murky but pleasantly temperate depths of pop culture on RN. My name is Tiger Webb, and this week on The List, a special on the intersection of language and popular culture. You heard Lauren there talk a bit about how dictionaries are fighting a losing battle when it comes to capturing language as it stands. Up soon, we'll talk to Sue Butler, editor of Australia's own Macquarie Dictionary, about how it is dictionaries can keep up with the sheer amount of new words that culture keeps spitting out. And does she think bubbling of the Todd Carney variety will make it into next year's edition? But first, the digital age and the ubiquity of computers and smartphones, along with the rise of tech giants like Google and Apple, have led to a shift in the types of metaphors we use to describe the world around us. Where we used to simply relax, we now, like the very machines we use, reboot. Howard Axelrod is an author and writer for the Boston Globe, and as he found out, sometimes the new metaphors we take from our culture can be a bit inadequate, especially when it comes to dealing with grief.
My friend called me up, and I could hear in his voice that something was amiss, and we warmed up by talking about basketball, but I knew there was something else that he wanted to talk about. Eventually, he got to it, and he said that his sister had relapsed and was using drugs again, and he said it was just really hard to process, and then I could almost hear him frowning over the phone as he said it, and he said that's the word everybody's using, process the emotions. But it makes it sound also neat, you know, so clean, and really it doesn't feel that way at all.
Because there's that implication that the brain, this organic thing, can function like a computer processor, isn't there?
Right. Well, that's the implication of that metaphor. I think it's part of why it's become popular, because we want an easy way to deal with the hard stuff in our lives. We want to think that we can process it, that we can move through it in a fashion similar to the way a computer would move through something, which means somewhat effortlessly, quickly, efficiently. But when it comes to our emotions, rarely do we move through them in a way that's efficient and fast. Usually it's recursive. We'll go through one step, then we'll go to another, then we'll cut back. Some things keep coming around. It's not like dealing with some business problem. It's dealing with something far more murky, something that we often can't see in its entirety as we're trying to move through it. So to use a metaphor from the world of computers, however optimistic, it's really not apt. And in fact, it's misleading and reductive, and I think can make people feel as though, you know, why is this so messy? Why am I having such a hard time? When really that's just how life is often.
So where does Howard Axelrod think that our metaphors previously came from?
Ralph Waldo Emerson, also a New Englander, writes about in his essay Nature how words used to come from the natural world. And so the word inspiration, for instance, comes from to breathe in. If something gives you a feeling of being breathed into, that's where we get the word inspire. And one word I particularly like is consider, or consider it, and that comes from the Latin word meaning to look at the stars or to gaze at the stars. So if you think of someone as being considerate, then they're listening to you in the way they might gaze at the stars. The language we use always comes from what's surrounding us, and as technology surrounds us more and more of our language will come from it. And that's fine for certain words. I do think sometimes metaphors from technology are useful and they're apt, but sometimes they're misleading. And so I think it is up to everyone, but particularly to writers, to try to defend the language, to try to look out for words that maybe are reductive or dehumanizing, especially when it comes to our inner lives.
Howard Axelrod is an author and writer for the Boston Globe. His recently completed memoir, The Point of Vanishing, is about the 2 years he spent in complete isolation in northern Vermont. You're on The List on RN. My name is Tiger Webb. This week we're looking at the ways that popular culture and language are linked. We talked a bit before on the show about how film, TV, music, they're continually giving us new words to play around with. But how do dictionaries keep up with this tide of new words? How do you decide which words have staying power and which words don't? Susan Butler is the editor of Australia's own Macquarie Dictionary.
So the rules about what is a real word have changed slightly. We are more inclined now to count slang, the words that come from pop culture, as real words, whereas in the past dictionaries at least said that they tried to record what was best in language. They recorded a sort of literary or proper or upmarket version of their English. Now the aim is to record everything from every aspect of language, warts and all. There is still a faint uneasiness about the words that are thrown up from time to time that have a brief moment and you think, is that real or not? And so to take the most immediate case in point, there is bubbling, the thing that brought about the downfall of Todd Carney. It does really have the feel of a sort of schoolboy prank and a dare and a childish sort of game.
We can't imagine bubbling, for example. We'd hope, I guess, it's not really sort of a word that's still in frequent use for this particular act in, you know, 10 years or 20 years. Hopefully it sort of dies out at the fad, like yo-yos, it'll go away.
And it is very Australian because we refer to the water fountain as the bubbler. So that's where we're getting our bubbling from. But really, I've written a note about it and I put it in my odds and sods drawer just to see whether maybe at the end of the year we'll have another look. The dictionary is now updated at the end of each year, so we'll see if there is still mention of bubbling or whether it was just given notoriety because of the importance of Todd Carney in the sporting world, and whether it's worth putting in or not, I'm still undecided.
Are there any words that have really surprised you, either by having a lot of staying power when you thought they might not, or the reverse?
Bromance, for instance, was one of the words that I looked at and thought, yeah, I really wonder whether this one has staying power.
Yeah, that entered the Macquarie Dictionary in 2006, didn't it, or 2007, one of the earlier
somewhere,
years.
That's right, it was there, and I still find bromance being used in all sorts of situations, sometimes humorously, you know, suspecting a bromance between two particular men.
Joe Hockey and Matthias Corwin.
Indeed.
Have a bromance.
That's right.
And so I did sort of allude to this earlier, but the Macquarie Dictionary did introduce this Word of the Year award. Why was that?
Well, I've always found it interesting to look at any lexicon under different headings, because you can see what the preoccupations are. So that if you look at the in terms of politics or architecture or, houses, sports, colloquialisms and so on, if you break it up into those sorts of subheadings, you can see where the growth areas are and what the preoccupations are. And if you do that year by year, it becomes quite an interesting record of, I mean, obviously there was one lot where the GFC just blasted everything and we all learned a lot of financial jargon that we'd never heard before. It is taking that notion that the language we use reflects our culture.
Along with the Word of the Year section, there's also the People's Choice Award with each year. Now, I was wondering, looking through this, is there much difference between what you pick as the editor or the panel picks and what people vote for with the People's Choice Award?
People's Choice tends to go for what is appealing and funny. And the committee tries to find a word that they feel captures the zeitgeist, you know, the preoccupation, the thing that was different about the previous year. So if you like, it's a rather more serious choice. So last year, the committee's choice was Infovore, because yes, there is this thing for with us all that we need information and we need it now. So everyone's getting out their devices to find out immediately what is the answer to how many toenails a wombat has, or, you know, whatever the question is of the moment. The people's choice, on the other hand, was onesie. I don't know if you know the onesie. It's the all-in-one garment, sort of like a loose pajama or a tracksuit with often an animal head and a tail. And
I am familiar with the onesie. I have been wondering, actually, if we've hit peak onesie.
I noticed in a shopping mall that they were offering discount onesies, and I thought, perhaps the fashion is on the way out.
Lauren Gawne is a linguist we had on the program a bit earlier, and she said that dictionaries are always fighting a losing battle against capturing language as it's used. And what's your take on that?
I was thinking to what I said earlier about my mother's dictionary and how she expected it to last her lifetime, and how we no longer have that sort of expectation of dictionaries. We expect them to be up to date. So it's almost working the other way for dictionaries. If you buy a dictionary that doesn't have onesie in it, you think, oh, that's a terrible dictionary. I mean, they somehow you expect them to magically incorporate every word that's being said in the way that digital dictionaries would do, I suppose. So now the dictionaries have moved online, there is much greater facility for incorporating the words that are very, very close to the moment of creation. It's impossible for us to be there at the moment of creation, particularly with colloquialism. It's still hard for dictionary editors to really capture that because we have to wait for it to turn up in print somewhere. So we have to wait for someone to use it in some kind of magazine or online where we're tracking things, sourcing information. And there's always this lag between the spoken language and the written language. Mm. I'd really like to have everyone wired up and be listening into all the conversations all around Australia, but that's not possible either. So I have to wait for it to turn up in print, which always introduces a time lag. But we are so much closer than we used to be that now we have the opposite problem of trying to make sure that we still abide by some sort of basic rules about what is a word worth putting in the dictionary, what is a real word as opposed to something that's just a passing creation or just a combination of two words or some particular person's invention, but not something that's actually generally used. To go in the dictionary, a word has to have general currency, which doesn't mean that the entire community has to use it. There'll always be a difference between the older generation and the younger generation. There'll always be particular groups, skateboarders or physicists or moviegoers or so on, who have particular words that they use. But as long as within that group, if you produce that word, you would expect to be understood, then it should be something that goes in the dictionary.
Susan Butler, editor of the Macquarie Dictionary. Lastly, here on the list, for our special look at the ways pop culture and language relate to one another, we're going to look at something a bit different. Sometimes a film or TV show might be so influential that not only do people quote it ad nauseum, they also name their children after it. Jamie Durham is a digital news producer at the Calgary Herald. When the province of Alberta released its top baby names of 2013, Jamie went back and looked at some of the more unusual names and the films that had inspired them.
I'm not sure what it is about The Matrix, but when you have a parent name their child Matrix sort of after its release, you realize it's something that hit people in a way that inspired at least some baby names. You know, we had names like Neo and Morpheus all of a sudden being used for children in Alberta, which had never or rarely been used prior to the movie's release. Trinity was another big one. Before the movie release, there was maybe a handful of Trinities, and then the year that it came out, it was in the double digits, and I think it peaked near 70, sort of in the mid-2000s. So to have this rare name before the movie comes out, and then all of a sudden dozens and dozens of children each year are getting the name, must be a bizarre experience.
So one other really unlikely name that got a bit of a boost because of television was Dexter.
Yes, Dexter is a TV show about a serial killer vigilante. So he kills mostly bad people, but at the same time, he's a serial killer. So why people are naming their children after a serial killer is a great question.
Well, the other funny thing I think about Dexter is, from what little I do know about this show, the ending really frustrated everyone that watched it. It was like 7 seasons. Only to get this really unsatisfying end. And so maybe there were some parents out there that were like, saw season one, thought, this is amazing. We are totally naming our unborn child Dexter. They have the child. And then they're like, oh no, that was so underwhelming. You know, 6 years later when the show finally finishes and he asks his parents, you know, hey, mom, dad, why'd you call me Dexter? And they're like, oh,
We just really like the name, son. Yeah. it wasn't anything to do with that TV show that was terrible. That's a good point. And it'll be interesting to see sort of if it drops off now that the show is done and finished in such a unsatisfying way. Because you're quite right. I don't, as a watcher of the show, I don't know anybody who enjoyed that particular ending.
I had to ask Jamie what his favorite baby names were in Alberta. And if you think the baby name Matrix was unlucky, well, there are some children out there who might just be wishing their parents were a bit more influenced by popular culture.
The funny one for me was the fact that there were people who named their children Unique, and in fact there were multiple Uniques, so the name itself wasn't actually all that unique. 15, I think, since 2002.
What if they met at a party?
I think there'd be lots of disappointment at that party.
Jamie Durham, digital news producer at the Calgary Herald. That's it for this week's special linguistics edition of The List. And from me, here's Cassie.
And thanks to Tiger Webb for that fascinating excursion into the world of popular culture and language. That's it for The List, but don't worry, just like Arnie, we'll be back. And don't forget that you can find the audio of today's show on the program page. And why not leave a comment? I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next week.